Ladies and gentlemen, welcome to Worst Foot Forward, the podcast where each week we celebrate the best of the worst. Except this week, yet again, as we adopt holding positions, myself and my co-host will be presenting the best of the best of the best of the best. Therefore, the winner in every single category in this episode is going to be a Navy SEAL called John Smith. Sir, yes, sir. And with me is the armor-plated beach ball to my own highly trained Navy SEAL... Barry the Punisher McStay.
I have never been called the Punisher in any context except one, which I'm not going into.
Yes, when you play board games with me and my wife.
That's the one, yeah.
You're the Punisher, she's the Destroyer, and I am...
The victim.
The victim, yeah.
Then the victim band. What would be your wrestling nickname?
We did this with Jim Smallman. Yeah. Ben the stationary salesman Cohen.
Yeah, so you take
your dad's job and your grandparents' surname.
Yeah, yeah.
Ben the stationary salesman Cohen.
Signature move.
The pencil sharpener.
Because I mean, you put them in a headlock and then you just rotate their body fully around.
Yes, exactly.
This is exciting. We're going back to episodes 21 to 25.
Yes, it is.
So if anyone hasn't listened to one of these episodes before, we go back to a few past episodes and look at the subjects in them and look at the best rather than the worst of those subjects. So those episodes took in Brian Lacey talking about the world's worst MMA fighter, Ivo Graham talking about the world's worst kids movie, Fiona Sagar talking about the world's worst cook, Natlert Seema talking about the world's worst lodgings, and Christian Talbot talking about the world's worst screen actor, brackets male.
Yeah, we've not done brackets female, or indeed...
I don't know if we're the people to do that.
Well, no, we'll get a men's rights activist on.
That's right, yeah.
That's what we need. Let's get Milo on, yeah. and I'm sure he'll be able to give us some insights into the female psyche.
Yeah.
Psyche or psyche?
Psyche, I think.
Yeah, otherwise I just...
Psyche!
Psyche, yeah, that's how I finished that sentence.
So you suddenly turned into, like, a bad boy from the 90s.
I suddenly turned into both PJ and Duncan.
Yeah.
Famous incels from the 90s, kids, if you don't know who they are.
By the way, shout out to our fans in Norway. Did you see we peaked in the top 300 or so in the Norwegian comedy charts?
Tack. I wonder if, and do let us know if this is you. So once, about twice a year at my comedy club, Good Ship Comedy, there is a migration of 16 and 17-year-old Norwegian students who come to London with their teacher to sample all of London's delights. And they come to my club as an example of the quintessential British stand-up comedy club.
Yeah, they come in through the north entrance one half of the year, and then 6 months later they come into the south entrance, heading back to Norway after spending their time at the equator.
Yeah, well, when they come back from the south, they're just laden down with all the stuff they've nicked from monasteries and some flaxen hair maidens that they've had their wicked way with. It's in their blood.
Like the juxtaposition that you think that they are not only raiding medieval monasteries but also listening to our podcast.
Yeah, well, no, they're very sophisticated and cultured barbarian raiders.
Yeah, presumably using on Bluetooth. Of course.
Oh, very good.
Thank you.
Very good. But yeah, if Norwegian listeners, that's you, that's the kids who came down to Good Ship Comedy, let us know. My favourite thing to do when they're on is obviously not tell any of the other acts.
Oh, yeah.
So at the start show, I was like, give me a cheer if you're from Britain. Yeah. Give me a cheer if you're from the United Kingdom. Yeah. Give me a cheer if you're from Norway. Rah! And looking at all the British people going, what is happening? Am I in some sort of portal back to the 9th century?
That is kind of great. I mean, you should do that every week with, like, before one of your acts arrives, just get the audience in on a joke that, okay, at some point when this act arrives, we're going to go, give me a cheer from Britain, you just keep quite quiet. When I say give us a cheer if you're from Kosovo, everyone just loses their shit. So the first thing we did, well, in episode 21, we talked with Brian Lacey about the world's worst MMA fighter. Our world's worst was a kid called Kyle Fletcher, who was beaten by the man previously thought to be the world's worst MMA fighter, Fred Ettich. So, who did take the title from a strong field of contenders for that. So, Ben, what have you found for a best MMA fighter?
Beaten to a pulp. Poor little Fred. Yeah. So I went down a rabbit hole of this. So there's a John Claude Van Damme movie called Bloodsport, and in it he takes part in something called a kumite. And
a committee? No. But yeah. In a Belgian accent.
Yeah. It's very long, very boring movie.
That sounds like someone British trying to speak French, but just saying English words in a French accent.
No, it's someone British trying to speak Japanese.
I am a member of a committee.
Okay, it's spelled K-U-M-I-T-E. Kumite.
Kumite, yeah.
Yeah, and it's basically an underground mixed martial arts competition, and in it there are times when he has to fight many people at one time. This is based on a real thing.
Oh.
So in Kyokushin karate, which is sort of like the most widely spread version of karate, the people who are right at the top of the karate tree.
Sure, yeah. Karate grows in the soil.
Yeah, it does. Well, yeah, you
harvested famously every August.
Yeah, you plant a severed, bloodied fist.
Yeah, yeah.
And the tree just grows 1 inch out of the soil, but it's really powerful. So basically, in order to sort of reach this next level, you have to pass this challenge that is devised by a chap called Masutatsu Oyama, who's the founder of this school of karate. And what you have to do, there's the 100-man kumite. There are various different types of kumite, which are sort of exercises that you have to do. But he devised the 100-man one, which consists of 100 rounds of 1.5 to 2 minutes of full contact sparring, where you basically have to fight 100 people.
Good God.
And it's basically just get to the end of it.
So it's like a Royal Rumble, but rather than everyone having to take everyone else out, it's everyone taking one guy out.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah,
and that one guy is number one into the ring.
Yeah.
Without a chair, or even.
Yeah, no chair, no like 4x4. Not 4x4, 2x4.
I mean, that would make the Royal Rumble so much better.
And it's Hulk Hogan in the Range Rover running over the Ultimate Warrior.
Someone's got, I've armed myself with a chair, I've armed myself with like a lead pipe. Yeah. Hulk's like, I've just got the keys to this.
Yeah. Oyama, he created this in the 60s. And
he said it's in the 60s. It's like an orgy went wrong.
Yeah. It's either that or it's a drunken boast. He was like, yeah, I could fight 100 guys. Not a problem. He was also known for fighting bulls barehanded.
Okay.
In his lifetime, he claimed to have battled 52 bills. 52.
Bill Clinton.
Bill Cosby.
Yeah.
Think of 48 other bills. Yeah. And that joke will be just as amusing on the
$10 bill.
He battled 52 bulls, three of which he purportedly killed instantly with one strike, earning him the nickname God Hand.
Did he fight them at the same time, or were they one by one?
That
he went to not allowed back into Pamplona.
No, he fought them 2x2.
Of course.
It was the Noah challenge.
Yeah.
No, that would be great if it was, if you were doing the Kumite challenge, it was like a man, a bull, a man, another man, three bulls.
You're declining a very weird Latin verb there. A man, a bull, a bull.
It's very silly.
I know.
It's probable that the whole thing about him taking a balls was mostly propaganda. And
you think?
Fixed. But what he did use, he definitely did fight bulls, but it was, hear me out, it was like a Japanese version of steer wrestling. So you know that, like, in the Wild West, cowboys do this thing where they'll sort of grab the bull by the horns, literally, yeah, and manoeuvre it round. And sometimes what will have happened is that the oxen's horns will have been pre-sawn, so he could give a blow to the back of the head. And like in a Desperate Dan cartoon, the horn would just lop off.
Oh, no.
So he created this challenge, Oyama, and about 14 or so people in history have ever completed it.
And Ben is currently in training to be number 15.
Yeah.
Da-da-da!
The thing that makes Oyama most incredible is that Oyama didn't complete this one time. He completed it 3 times.
What? So 300 guys.
Yep, in 3 days.
No,
so he's,
fuck off.
He's like the Eddie Izzard doing 43 marathons in 51 days.
Wow. Were they the same guys? Because, you know, if he'd broken them the first day, then it's slightly less impressive on day 2.
No, I think it was, imagine being guy number 300. Just like, just looking at this pile of bodies that are stacked up. He's like, I think I'm all right. He's just hiding behind the pile of bodies, and Iyama's chasing him round and round the pile of bodies.
And the thing is, until he's like 10th in the queue, he hasn't actually seen what's been going on. So he's just, you know, he's just shown up, and joined a queue, and suddenly he gets to the front and sees what he's. He thought he was queuing for like free samples.
Yeah. He is stuck queuing for free samples of a knuckle sandwich. So although he's not technically an MMA fighter, I reckon Iyama could absolutely hold his own.
Yeah, it sounds like it.
And because he invented this astonishing challenge, he's my selection for the best ever MMA fighter.
Cool. I'm going back to the old days, Ben.
Great.
And I'm going to tell you a bit about Theagenes of Thasos. 5th century BC, became very famous in the ancient world at the age of 9. Child prodigy was Theagenes, because he was walking home from school one day through the market in Thasos when he saw a shiny bronze statue of a god, maybe Zeus, and decided to take it home with him. So he ripped it from its plinth. This is a 9-year-old child. And obviously, ancient Greece at the time, very religious. This was a blasphemous act as far as people were concerned. There was talk of what they should do with him. Should they execute him? He had to be punished until some of the wiser heads prevailed and said, no, he's a child. Why don't we just get him to put it back where he found it?
Good.
But at that point, he'd become famous throughout the ancient world. It's a bit like Tiger Woods appearing on TV, you know, chipping golf balls or putting at the age of 5 or whatever.
Yep.
And this was recorded by Pausanias, who was basically the ancient Greek Barry Glendening. he was a famous sports writer, writing colour pieces about all the ancient Olympic games and things like that. So at the age of 9, he was already destined for great things. So he cultivated his strength and his bad boy image as he grew older and older. He won the Olympic boxing title in 480 BC and then decided to branch over into Pankration, which is the mixed martial art that they did, in 476, won that. In fact, he also won 3 Pythian games, 9 Nemean games, and 10 Isthmian games. So those are the other, they were sort of 4 ancient sort of sporting games at the time. Had a 22-year-long career in boxing, Pankration, and wrestling, and won apparently over 1,400 fights. Ooh. Yeah, to put that into context, Willie Pep, who's considered the greatest boxer of the 20th century, his final record was 229-11-1, I think. Certainly in terms of the amount of fights he fought.
I was going to say, I don't think Willie Pep is the greatest boxer of the 20th century.
Most prolific boxer, I should say, maybe.
Right, okay.
He fought 241 fights and won 229 of them. Theagenes, 1,200 more fights than Willie Pep did. And he also, by the way, in amongst all this, won the long race at one of the games as well. So he was a runner as well as a fighter.
Oh, he's that old Victorian gentleman, isn't he? Yeah.
He could do pretty much anything.
Open the batting for Sparta.
Yeah, exactly that. Garlanded up to his oxters. Even in death, he could be pretty vicious. Because after he died, there were several statues, apparently, to him all throughout the ancient world, among the Greeks and among the barbarians, as the ancients called them as well. So he was a very famous hero. But one of the statues of him in Thasos, in his hometown, he had an opponent who had never been able to beat him in life, as many people hadn't. And this opponent had taken it particularly badly. And so every knight would get a bit pissed, get like the branch of a tree or a whip or something, and would start beating the statue of Theagenes. Until one night, it turned out that the statue fell on top of his opponent and killed him. So even then, still getting the better of his opponent, the family of this guy obviously then accused the statue of murder. And the punishment for murder was exile. So the statue was exiled by being thrown into the sea by the local authorities. A few years later, there was a drought in Thasos, and the Oracle of Delphi suggested that the remedy for this would be to recall everybody who was in exile. So the people of Thasos recalled everyone in exile, but the drought continued until somebody remembered that the statue was still at the bottom of the moat. So some fishermen went out, got their nets, and raised the statue again, and the drought miraculously finished.
I like the fact that both of us clearly went on the internet, took one look at those lists of big sweaty men who we know nothing about but clearly are guests on the Joe Rogan podcast every week. We were like, nah, not today.
Yeah.
To the history books.
Yeah, I've also decided I'm not going to mention Conor McGregor.
But then Conor McGregor, I say this as someone who is absolutely not qualified to. He's very good. I don't think he's the best.
He's a prick as well.
He's also a massive prick.
Yeah.
Come
at me, McGregor. You heard me. I said you're a prick.
That's just why I'm waiting for him to burst through the wall of the studio.
So who are we going to pick? We got Oyama or Theagenes? I think Theagenes has got a bit more MMA to him. Masutatsu doesn't seem like he'd have like a second string to his bow. He's got the karate thing going on.
He's not got a ground game.
He's not got the ground game.
Which is the important thing. So you reckon Theagenes would defeat Oyama?
I mean, he beat everybody else. Even as a statue and dead several years. next up, we talked to Ivo Graham about the world's worst kids movie. The winner was the infamous Patch Adams, which Ivo Graham'd. Too saccharine and diabetes inducing for human consumption. We also had a lengthy chat about Sidney Poitier's ghost dad and the Whoopi Goldberg vehicle Theodore Rex as well.
Oh gosh, I forgot about Theodore Rex.
That was a fun podcast to do. But Ben, let's go back to our childhoods.
Yeah.
And let's go to a classic, one of the classics. Let's talk about The Wizard of Oz.
Oh, okay.
Yeah. It is one of those films that I think the first time you see it really does stay with you. It is a completely magical experience.
Yeah. I think the first time I watched it fully was when I did the other thing you need to do with The Wizard of Oz, which is to watch it whilst listening to Dark Side of the Moon.
Oh, you did it that way around.
Yeah, I did. If you don't know this, listeners, because I mentioned it in passing the other day to someone.
Dark Side of the Rainbow, isn't that what it's this?
Oh, is that the nickname?
I believe so,
Oh,
yeah.
Great. So what you have to do, you have to sync it up. So you press play on the third roar of the lion, of the MGM lion.
Yeah.
And then the first 43 minutes of the film match the soundtrack, and it's for the first sort of 3 or 4 minutes
of Dark Side of the Moon.
Yeah. And obviously, when Dark Side of the Moon finishes, you put on Wish You Were Here, and after that, you put on.
Wish I Was Home.
The first 5 minutes fits a little bit when one piece of music metamorphizes into another, and it completely hits the change from black and white to Technicolor. And also, I think it's called is it On the Run, which is the mad sort of electronica music on track 3 that syncs up to the tornado.
Yeah.
And as soon as they're in Oz, it's perfect.
Yeah. I just was reading some of the interesting facts about it last night. It was nominated for 6 Oscars, including Best Picture, which it lost to Gone with the Wind, which was directed by the same director.
Bloody hell.
Yeah, Victor Fleming. So actually, both films had a couple of directors, but Victor Fleming directed pretty much all of The Wizard of Oz and then took over Gone with the Wind, which was having trouble on the production. So he ended up completing Gone with the Wind as well.
Yeah.
He was the credited director on both. If you've directed 2 films in your life and they're Gone with the Wind and The Wizard of Oz.
Yeah, stick up your feet.
Yeah, exactly. Have a rest.
I mean, surely the subtitle of The Wizard of Oz could just be Gone with the Wind.
That he only does wind-based films.
Yeah.
Wait for Inherit the Wind to come along. It did win 2 Oscars, Best Score and Best Original Song for Over the Rainbow. It only turned a profit in 1949 when it was re-released. It didn't make a profit the first time around.
Well, because it didn't do well.
It did all right, but it was very expensive to make for lots of reasons, the Technicolor aside, but also production problems and so on. And then it sort of gained the place in America's heart in 1956 when CBS broadcast it across on network TV. It was too long to fit in a 90-minute slot, which is what they were going to do. So they expanded it to 120 minutes. But even with ads, that wasn't quite enough. So they added in celebrity hosts for the broadcasts. And the hosts were Bert Lahr, who played the Cowardly Lion, and Liza Minnelli, who was 10 years old at the time, Judy Garland's daughter.
She's Judy Garland's daughter.
Does she not know that Liza is Judy Garland's daughter?
No.
Ugh, I keep forgetting you're not gay.
There you go.
It is the most seen movie in history, according to the Library of Congress in America. Mm-hmm. It's one of the first 25 films that they inducted into the National Film Register in 1989. So they sort of collect films of particular artistic merit. And it's on this thing, which I had never heard of, the UNESCO Memory of the World Register. So this is a UNESCO list of vital documents and manuscripts that contain lots of human memory and history. So it includes the Magna Carta, the Book of Kells, the manuscripts of Che Guevara. It includes records of slaving companies, of royal archives around the world, of different poetry and journals of explorers and so on. And there are very few films in it, and The Wizard of Oz is one of those films that's in it. Yeah.
How long before it was filmed did L. Frank Baum write the story?
There was a musical version of it in 1902, I think. And there had been a silent film version of it in 1920.
Oh, wow.
But a lot of the stuff in the film is new. and or borrows from the stage version and things like that.
I mean, it's a fairy tale in its structure. When you think of the gifts that the Scarecrow, the Tin Man,
yeah.
Dorothy, and the Lion are after, and the stock characters that they are, it seems like it's hundreds of years old.
Yeah, yeah, it does have a sort of timeless quality to it, which is amazing. But they did think about updating the story slightly for the film mm-hmm. version. There were the film included a song called The Jitterbug for the kids, and had a series of musical contests where Dorothy would have to sing or dance off against certain characters. They were obviously cut from the later final cut. There is a bit at the end where Hunk, who's the farmhand, who's the cipher for the Scarecrow.
Yep.
So that's Ray Bulger's character. He makes Dorothy promise to write to him when he goes to agriculture college at the end mm-hmm. of the film. And that's cut in the film. But it explains why Dorothy says to the Scarecrow, "I think I'm going to miss you most of all." Which is such like a slap in the face to the other two that she spent the rest of the film with. But it's because they had this like, oh, we need to have some sort of romance and maybe the idea of a sequel seeded in there. So that's what that's all about. There was some interesting stuff about casting. W.C. Fields was going to play the wizard.
Oh, yes,
yeah,
please.
But he haggled over his fee too long, so they got Frank Morgan, who was a regular player for MGM, to step in. Ray Bulger was originally meant to play the Tin Man. He ended up playing the Scarecrow. He really wanted to play the Scarecrow, and he mm-hmm. thought it was the part that would suit him more. So he made Buddy Ebsen, who had been cast as the Tin Man, swap with him, and he was happy to do that. And then Ebsen had an allergic reaction to the silver paint he was wearing as the Tin Man. So that put him in hospital, leading to him being completely replaced anyway by Jack Haley.
Oh my God. He got gold-fingered out of there.
Yeah, not only that, but Margaret Hamilton, who played the Wicked Witch of the West, her green makeup was toxic. She would have to have liquid lunches because she wasn't able to sort of risk getting any of the paint in her spoon or her cutlery as she was putting food into her mouth. She then suffered third-degree burns by the fire, which explodes underneath the Wicked Witch while she's melting in the melting bit of the film, which was on the second take. They had a perfectly good first take. And they thought, let's have another go at it. And she ended up in hospital for 3 months as well. So when they did pickups, it's actually her stand-in, Betty Danko, doing it, who also got injured by the smoke machine being used in that scene. So, you know, tricky. Tricky in parts. They were also filming in Technicolor for the first time, and to really make it sing out, they had to use extraordinarily hot studio lights. So in the studio, it was sometimes like 100 degrees. Which is why when you look at their, they are like slightly damp,
with a sheen. Yeah.
To really make it stand out. The silver slippers from the book were changed to ruby slippers so that they would stand out on the screen and make it ping. And there were 5 pairs made, at least, that were used in filming. The last pair to go on sale were auctioned in 2000. And sold for $666,000. They are one of the most expensive movie props in history. It has a 98% rating on Rotten Tomatoes.
Mm-hmm, good.
And Roger Ebert says, "Its underlying story penetrates straight to the deepest insecurities of childhood, stirs them, and then reassures them."
Oh, Roger.
Yeah.
It's incredible, isn't it? Because if you try and write a fairy tale, it's so easy to get that wrong and make it seem cloying and saccharine and oversimplified. But if you hit on the right notes, it feels like it's been written forever.
Yeah, and what an amazing feat to go from black and white to colour like that. And it is, even like by modern standards who are used to seeing colour films, that transition is just extraordinary.
Yeah. And Somewhere Over the Rainbow is one of the best songs of all time.
It was nearly cut. The film was too long and they were cutting songs left, right and centre from it.
Oh my God.
And they nearly cut that because someone thought it was sort of kind of, it was a bit unseemly to have a song in a farmyard to make Judy Garland sing in a farmyard. They nearly cast Shirley Temple in that role as well until they decided that they needed someone with a little bit more heft.
Yeah. Cool. Let me put up a suggestion that is not as good as yours. I decided that what we needed to do after we gave him such a kicking in the original episode with Ivo, I needed to rehabilitate Robin Williams.
I mean, I adore Robin Williams.
Me too.
Genuinely one of the most affecting celebrity deaths I think I've ever had, because mm-hmm. he was the most famous actor, as far as I was concerned, when I was like between the ages of 5 and 10.
Yeah. Oh no, absolutely blew my mind as a kid watching Jumanji and Mrs. Doubtfire.
Yeah.
And Good Will Hunting is...
And Genie. Genie in Aladdin. He's so good.
Yeah, that was the first film I watched after he died, and the bit at the end where he gets his freedom was a little bit too much.
No.
But I'm going to go for a film that is not as good as The Wizard of Oz, but it's one of the first films I ever remember watching in the cinema, which is Hook.
Ah, Hook is so good. That was one of the first I saw in the cinema as well.
Flawed masterpiece.
It's so good.
Flawed, bloated masterpiece.
Yeah.
If you have not seen it, if you're of the wrong age or vintage or just never got round to it, Hook has the genius idea that Peter Pan moved into this realm and got old and became a lawyer and got married. And Wendy, played by Dame Maggie Smith, who's in makeup to make her look older than she is now.
Yes.
Very confusing.
Yeah, it is really weird because you look at Maggie Smith now and you go, oh, you look younger than that. Have you time travelled?
Pretty much. Yeah, so Maggie Smith's in it as old Wendy and he's just forgotten about it. And
young Gwyneth Paltrow.
Yeah, as his one of his daughters. Yeah. We'll talk about the cameos in a moment because there are some ridiculous cameos, and watching Robin Williams play a downtrodden, angry, unimaginative, working for the man lawyer is equally heartbreaking.
Yeah, he looks out of place.
Yeah,
and it's because he's usually such a madcap character.
The scene for me that got me, I wanted to live where the Lost Boys did in their mad tree houses, and when they have the imaginary food fight, when they suddenly start seeing the food and throwing it at each other.
It's like their paintballs. It's amazing, that scene. It's, yeah, you're doing it, Peter. You're playing with us.
looking back on it now, it is slightly cringeworthy early 90s cool with a capital K and a Z on the end.
Oh yeah, yeah, like Rufio was too cool for school. But then when Rufio gets killed, spoilers, but that is properly, it hits you.
And you're
used to seeing bad adults get killed in films. Like you get stormtroopers being shot and things like that. You're not used to seeing like a child hero being killed.
Yeah, it's quite a rug pull.
Yeah, yeah.
And I loved the little fat lost boy who turned himself into a bowling ball.
Oh, cannonball.
That's the one. Dustin Hoffman as Captain Hook is perfect.
Absolutely outstanding. Better than Rain Man.
Yeah.
And Bob Hoskins as Smee is in the role of a lifetime. Second role of a lifetime after Roger Rabbit.
Yeah, exactly. He looks such a cartoon character in that.
Yeah.
So the pair of them are absolutely brilliant. Well, whilst we're talking about the actors in it, you have the worst cameo is Phil Collins playing a police detective when the kids disappear.
That's right.
Yeah, Phil Collins making Sting look like a good actor.
Yeah.
And then there are loads of Steven Spielberg's mates who are in the pirate crew. David Crosby from Crosby, Stills, Nash and Young.
Right, yeah.
Basically just looking like David Crosby. But then the best one is there's a pirate who tries to mutiny against Hook. When I last watched it, I did a double take. I'm like, is that Glenn Close in a beard?
Yeah.
And it is Glenn Close in a beard.
She gets shoved into the boom box, doesn't she?
She gets shoved into a box full of scorpions.
Yeah, yeah.
And then the other one that I didn't realise, right at the very end when Peter is flying off, fairy dust falls into a couple on a bridge in London who are kissing. And that couple is George Lucas and Carrie Fisher.
That's right, yeah.
Because Carrie Fisher script doctored some of the film.
Yes, she did. Oh, yeah. She's so good at everything.
She is so good at everything. And a real sense of threat as well. You're sort of rooting for Hoffman in a little way because he's a great buddy. In a similar way to in Wizard of Oz where there's double playing of parts. At the beginning, Dustin Hoffman provides the voice of the airline pilot when the Bannings fly to England.
Of course
he does, because the line he says is, "This is your captain speaking." So good, right?
So good.
But who do you think would be absolutely the worst, most inappropriate, film-destroying person to cast in the role as Peter Pan, the boy who never grew up?
Nicolas Cage. Bruce Willis.
I mean, two very good shouts.
Tom Cruise.
No.
Al Pacino.
Nope. Michael Jackson.
No!
Yeah.
No!
Just imagine.
No!
Rufio there, protecting all the lost boys from him.
No, man. Dodged a bullet there.
It was even going to be a musical if Jackson was cast. Two of the songs that were already written were called We Don't Want to Grow Up and When You're Alone.
Yeah,
right. So, yeah, I love Hook, but clearly Wizard of
clearly
Oz.
Clearly Wizard of Oz is the best of all time. Let's talk about cooks. Ben, you're a gourmand.
I like eating.
A dab hand in the kitchen. Who would you say is the world's best cook?
My mum. Done. Shit, my wife!
Oh, wow. That's the ultimate nightmare for a young Jewish boy.
Yeah.
Is that genuinely, your wife's quite a good cook. She makes a lovely pie every New Year's Day.
Yeah, she's pretty goddamn good. Between her
and the Italian.
Yeah, I've watched her and her dad make tomato sauce. And I've watched it stage by stage. And I'm like, right, you're frying off onions. You are adding a bit of garlic. You're putting in tomatoes. You're cooking them down. I can do all that. Why does your sauce taste better than my sauce? I'm doing exactly what you're doing. Yours has body and depth and heart and soul.
It's like Guinness being made in Ireland, then. It just tastes better.
Yeah. Yeah, no, I make it. I mean, listen, I have eaten in some incredibly nice restaurants all over the world.
Have you eaten the Fat Duck?
I have eaten
You have eaten in the Heston Blumenthal's place, yeah.
Yeah, the best. Well, I will briefly tell you about that.
Because I've never eaten there and I'm kind of curious.
Yeah, so it is definitely a disgusting amount of money.
But you have to have the tasting menu.
Yeah, it's the only thing available. Yeah. But of all of the too much money that you could pay in posh restaurants, it is the most worth it. My wife got me into eating in posh restaurants, and at first I was like, that much money for something I'm only going to see again once that doesn't look nearly as pretty as when I saw it the first time? I think not. But when you think about how well-sourced the ingredients are, because I love making sort of street food because it makes me sound super hip, and also you can be slapdash with a presentation. But to make something look like an incredible work of art and taste amazing is astonishing skill.
And add theatre to it as well.
Yeah. So there, there are certain posh restaurants you go to and you're like, this is probably a bit much. But weirdly, even though the Fat Duck is the most I've paid for a meal by any stretch of the imagination.
How much is it?
The menu on its own, I think, is almost a couple of hundred quid.
Okay, yeah.
But I basically thought of it as like having a city break, but in an evening.
And what, did you get like 10, 12?
14.
14 plates of food.
Yeah, yeah. Like 14 plates of food going up in size.
Yeah.
And some of it is the most astonishing things I've ever put in my mouth.
Yeah. Speak for yourself.
I just laid that open goal for you and
sorry.
You put a giant phallus through it.
I'm so sorry. I'm such a goal poacher.
Yeah.
That's what we're calling it these days. Oh, yeah.
Pigeon was on there that I loved. And there's a Black Forest Gatto cake where basically it's 7 layers, and the final layer, they take the 6 layers that they put up, they take it to a separate room, they put on basically a hazmat suit and spray it with pure chocolate. But my favourite thing is they did mock turtle soup. You get a glass bowl with an egg in it with tiny little mushrooms in the egg, and then they bring along a glass teapot with a broth inside it and a case, and you open up the case and there's a gold pocket watch and you pop the pocket watch into the glass bowl and
they pour the
broth over it and the pocket watch melts inside it, and that is served with toast sandwiches. And bear in mind, I've eaten some of the weirdest and poshest things you can eat. The best thing that I have ever eaten at the best restaurant I've ever been to was a toast sandwich.
That's so good.
Because clearly what he'd done is got like, you got 3 pieces of bread, and one of the piece of bread, he just basically gone, all the sauces, mate.
Yeah.
I'd swear he just went, bit of mustard, bit of ketchup, bit of mayo, bit of salad cream, la 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 la. Put it on a grill, put it between 2 slices of bread, and it tasted transcendental.
Wow.
But I must tell you, when I went there, I struggled to finish everything because about an hour and a half before we went to what is many considered by many to be the best restaurant in the world, I said to my wife, I'm a bit peckish.
No, no.
And I went and had a Tesco Value cheese and onion sandwich.
You absolute dickhead.
I was just calibrating. That's all I was doing.
I want to hit you with this notebook. How dare you? I wouldn't have eaten for a week. What was the sandwich?
Cheese and onion. It's really good. It's really good.
All right. So are you picking your wife though as the best cook, or your mum? Or Heston Blumenthal? Or Tesco's?
I would pick Tesco. No. I am going to say that my mum, on the occasions that she makes chicken soup, because my mama's chicken soup is better than all your mama's chicken soups, and it brings all the kosher boys to the yard.
So, the chef of the century, according to the GOAT Milo, is Joel Robuchon,
mm-hmm.
who died last year. He was awarded that title in 1989. He had 12 or more wrestlers.
It's a bit early.
Yes, I know.
So 11 more years left to go.
Who knows what could have happened?
Yeah, that's like leaving the stadium with 5 minutes to go.
I hadn't started cooking by the age of four. You know? And they missed me out. He opened about a dozen restaurants worldwide. He had, at one point, 32 Michelin stars, which is ridiculous. He had 31 when he died. The next highest on the list, I think, is Alain Ducasse, somewhere in the early 20s. So by far the most Michelin-starred restaurant.
Yeah, he deserves to have them all taken away from them because he gave me food poisoning.
Alain Ducasse did.
Yeah, first posh restaurant Sylve's parents ever took me to at the, I think it was the Dorchester. Bear in mind, you know, going out for dinner with your then-girlfriend's parents, and I had some langoustines and they did a salsa in my stomach and I was sat opposite Sylve's mum on the tube home looking her in the eye thinking, oh, I think I might be about to shit myself in front of my new girlfriend's mum.
And that's worth not going to star off Alain Ducasse, yeah, at least.
Exactly.
Robichaud opened his restaurant Jarman in 1981 and immediately won 3 Michelin stars for it and held them for the first 3 years of his existence.
Wow.
It's very rare for that to happen. He also is the mentor to Gordon Ramsay, who's third on the list. I mean, whatever you think of Gordon Ramsay, he is the third most Michelin-starred chef in history with 16. For Robichaud to have 32 of his own and then be responsible, if you like, for 16 more is
I don't know much about Jean Robichaud, but I imagine he is the warm, genial Bobby Robson to the flaming arsehole of Jose Mourinho. Yeah, that is Gordon Ramsay.
I think that's very much the relationship. It seems that way. He apparently he had quite a bad temper, but all the photos I've seen of him, he looks very smiley. But I did want to talk about Alexis Soyer. Have you heard of him? So he's maybe the first celebrity chef. He was French, born in 1810, died in 1858, and he was chef to various French politicians and aristocrats and so on. And he fled to England after the 1830 revolution and worked for lots of notables in the UK at the time, various barons and dukes and lords of various places. And in 1837, he was appointed chef of the newly founded Reform Club, one of the private members' clubs in London, and designed their kitchen, instituted new reforms and ideas like cooking with gas, using refrigerators that cooled using cold water, ovens that had adjustable temperatures. They were the wonder of the age. In fact, they conducted tours of the kitchens at the Reform Club.
Wow.
Because it was so famous. He was paid a £1,000 per annum salary for his role there. On the day of Queen Victoria's coronation, he cooked breakfast for 2,000 people in the club. And his lamb cutlets reform are still on the menu there, even now, 170 years later.
That's incredible. Yeah, to have a recipe last that long.
Yeah, it is, isn't it? But he was very good at self-promotion as well, because obviously he became famous. And he went to a company called Cross and Blackwell and had them promote Soyer's Sultana sauce in a very exotic-looking bottle with his own face on the front of it, doing a Paul Newman with him in a hat. And so even like he, that was the where he really became famous around the country. He published a book called Shilling Cookery for the People in 1854, which was a cookbook for poor people as opposed to for the wealthy. He went to Ireland during the famine and established the soup kitchens there. Printed a charity cookbook where he gave all of his proceeds to help relieve the famine in Ireland. His soup that he served in the soup kitchen, not great in the nutritional value, but, you know, a better effort than most. He also invented a tabletop stove called Soyer's Magic Stove. And the Soyer stove was a field stove he invented for the British Army, which was still in use in various guises until the first Gulf War. He tried to reform the support for the military. Ooh. By having a chef for each regiment, like a cook, and they didn't properly have like an official army catering corps until the 1940s. But Soyer was even trying to do it even then.
That's my grandfather-in-law. He was a military chef.
Was he?
Yeah, I like the thought of a military chef just kind of like going into battle, flinging hors d'oeuvres like Molotov cocktails,
sharpened breadsticks.
Yeah.
Not every endeavour of Soyer's was a success. When the Great Exhibition was taking place in Hyde Park in 1851, Soyer thought, you know what, this massive worldwide event needs a rival. And he's founded something called the Universal Symposium of All Nations, literally opposite the Great Exhibition, which did not do well. He lost £7,000.
Oh, dear.
Or in his case, 7 years' salary. Yeah, one of the pioneers of a lot of the things that we now think is quite commonplace. So we've got your mum, Ben, and Alexis Soyer.
I mean,
and who am I to argue?
I think it's no contest.
Who are you going to pick, Ben?
I'm
going to give the choice to you, so you have to make that decision.
The choice
with the sword of Damocles.
Wow, so
hanging over your head.
A man who pioneered cooking techniques, cooked for the great and the good and the poor and the vulnerable, and whose recipes maintained for 170 years, or the woman who made me with her own flesh and blood and toils over a stove to make magnificent chicken soup and knedlach and really good roast chicken, and if we're being perfectly honest, quite average everything else.
Answer the question, Ben. Who is the better chef?
No, now.
Answer the question.
Hear me out, Mr. Paxman.
Did you ever threaten to overrule this podcast?
It wasn't best chef, it's best cook.
It is.
And cook is a different thing, because a cook is not someone who works in restaurants and wears the whites.
Not solely, no.
No. A cook is something more homely.
Yeah.
More spiritual, yeah. More soulful.
This podcast is rigged. Are you about to backflip your way out of this dead end by saying you're picking your mum as a representative for all of our mum's cookings?
No, only for all of our Jewish mum's cookings. If you're telling me that an Irish mum is a better cook than a Jewish mum, we will duke this out.
Well, congratulations, Deanna Vandervelde, the world's best cook. This is the worst decision on the show since you picked Mrs. Brown's Boys, which wasn't even a candidate in the episode it was in.
Mrs. Brown is not as good a cook as my mum.
Next, we're talking about the world's worst lodgings with Natlert Seema. We picked the pillar on which Simeon Stylites, the early Christian saint, perched himself for the guts of 40 years. I read about the most expensive private homes in the world.
Oh.
And the most expensive home in the world is thought to be Buckingham Palace. But it's obviously not a private home because it's owned by the Crown Estates.
The thing is, the Crown and the State are also mixed up in each other. Like, I can claim that I've got a part share in Buckingham Palace, but will they let me round there to watch?
Which room would you like? if you all had a room each, like once a year.
Oh, I mean, I've never been there. Which room would I like? I'd like the billiard room.
Oh, yeah. There's definitely a billiard room.
Yeah.
I think I would go with one of the larders because I imagine they have some really good cheese.
What? You just be there like one of the mice from Cinderella.
Completely, yeah. Absolutely. And I would eat my way through a massive wheel of cheese and then live in that. And they'd never find me. So the most expensive private home in the world is a building called Antilia, which is in Mumbai. It's owned by Mukesh Ambani, who's the chair of Reliance Industries, which is one of those ridiculous holding companies, which basically owns lots of other companies through it. It was a building finished in February 2010. The architects were Perkins and Will, and its cost was between $1 and $2 billion. Yeah.
Wow.
Yeah. It has 27 floors.
And that's a house.
That is, one family lives in it. Yeah. It is 173 meters tall, which is actually the usual size for a building, about twice the size. So they've got ridiculously high ceilings on every floor in the building.
So it should be 54 floors high.
It could be up to 60 stories, depending on how high you put the average ceiling. But yeah, he does have a staff of 600 people who are also presumably living in various lodgings in the place. But they do have, you know, six floors devoted to his cars and things like that.
But each car has like a bedroom,
yeah,
with a four-poster bed that it's in.
A larder with wheels of cheese in it. It's only on 1.12 acres of land, so obviously very tall, not massive. I mean, it's quite big, but not massive.
It's a big threat to earthquakes.
Yes.
I love it. If there was an earthquake, then it would start shooting out cars like a Pez dispenser.
People in Mumbai going, I've won a prize! The 1.12 acres it's built on is the site of a former orphanage. Which was home to 60 orphans before they, knocked it to build this skyscraper house for this ridiculously stupidly rich man. There was a rumour in 2011, 2012 that he still hadn't moved into it for fear of bad luck. So actually, my favourite choice of lodgings, it's not even probably the great place to live, but just for its setting, everything, is Falling Water. It's the famous Frank Lloyd Wright building, which has the waterfall flowing underneath it.
Yeah, which is not very structurally sound.
So, well, we might come to that.
Okay.
Yeah. It's in Bear Run, Pennsylvania. If you haven't seen it, just Google the word Falling Water. Then you will realise you have seen it. It is a beautiful cantilevered house, four bedrooms. It was built in 1936 to 1939.
What does cantilevered mean?
So it has parts of the building are sticking out from the main body of it. So you've got these really long, seemingly unsupported balconies. You know, some cantilevers might have struts underneath them. In this case, the concrete is reinforced to hold it out. So you've got these long terraces which stick out over the water and so on.
Right.
It was built as a weekend retreat for the Kaufman family, who were a wealthy department store owning family, like I said, in the late 30s. Now, Frank Lloyd Wright, who was the architect, was already 67 years old. He was thought that his time had passed at this point.
Wow.
But he had been getting very into Japanese architecture, and that he had a sort of a rebirth in the world of architecture with this building.
In Japanese architecture, if you want to become an architect, you have to fight off 99 other architects.
So he has all these beautiful straight lines and sort of slightly minimalist feeling to it. He drew up the plans in 2 hours.
Oh, come on.
Yeah. So they had done all the surveys and some of his assistants and apprentices had done site visits and all of that stuff. And then they were told that Kaufman was on his way. Lloyd Wright had said, oh yeah, I've done the plans, I've done it, and had kept putting them on the long finger, and then was told, no, he's going to be here literally in 2 hours. So while his apprentices were stood around panicking, Lloyd Wright calmly drew up these plans, presumably on the back of a napkin, and designed this building over the top of the waterfall. Now, Kaufman had originally wanted it below the waterfall, and the famous photo is taken from below, which was apparently his favourite view, so you could see the falls. But Lloyd Wright convinced him that actually it would be even more impressive to have the house up above it. It's got 4 bedrooms, and he wanted to be able to entertain large groups, which is why you have the cantilevered rooms, so they could make the site do more, despite the small, relatively small ground space. The cantilevers, Kaufman was slightly dubious about Lloyd Wright's ability to work with concrete and stuff like that, so he had their structural soundness reviewed by an engineer. At which point, Frank Lloyd Wright threatened to withdraw his plans completely.
Oh, no.
Yeah, and his gambit paid off because Kaufman apologised and the engineer's review was buried in one of the walls of the house. It was quite pricey. The estimate cost was $35,000. It actually cost $155,000. They built an extra little guest house for extra guests. And in 1963, 25 years after it was finished, Kaufman Jr. donated the building to the Western Pennsylvania Conservancy Group. And now it's a national monument. Some of the cantilevers began to sag ever so slightly.
Mm-hmm.
And there is some water damage in the building, which they repair every year because they've got cork tiles among the bathrooms, so they just have to keep repairing them. So the cantilevers were supported by steel structures for a short while. And then in the early 2000s, they did a job where they ran steel cables internally through them, basically giving them extra support. So now it's completely structural. It's completely structurally sound again. You could give me a 27-story building to live in, but I'd much rather a lovely little 4-bedroom house in a forest with a waterfall running underneath it any day of the week.
Sounds beautiful.
Yeah.
When was it built?
1936 to 39.
Nothing. Nothing compared to where we're going for mine. We're going back to Japan, my friend. And we are going back to a hotel in Hayakawa in the Yamanashi Prefecture.
Mm-hmm.
And this is a hotel called Nishiyama Onsen Keiunkan. And it is a hotel that was founded in 705 AD.
Wow! Has it been a hotel continuously?
It has been a hotel for 1,300 years.
That's amazing!
Yep.
There aren't very many single-use buildings like that around still today.
Gosh, I guess not. I mean, it is the oldest hotel in the entire world.
That's amazing.
And I find this whenever I look at Japanese history, because hotels in Europe grew out of coach houses and inns, and those only really grew up in sort of like the medieval period when, you know, cities begin to grow again and you need people to ride between two cities, and if two cities are too far apart, you need coach houses and inns. But Japan was so much more sophisticated than Europe for so much longer before than you'd think.
Yeah, yeah.
Pre-Jesus Japan probably looked more sophisticated than post-Battle of Hastings Britain. So it has been in the family of the founder, Fujiwara Mihito, for 52 generations. And brilliantly, it is actually just a 6-hour drive from the world's second oldest hotel, the Hoshi Ryokan, which is opened 13 years later.
Imagine you show up at the oldest hotel and you go, oh, we don't have room, but, you know.
Just
if you fancy being a bit down market, the world's second oldest hotel is but a mere 6-hour drive away.
Similar to the house you popped up with, because it's on a natural spring. All of the water comes from it, both hot and cold, and the spring runs through the hotel. So it's got a sort of a bit of a health spa feel. It's also a return to nature because it's in the middle of nowhere. Mm. Very, very spare and unbelievably good service.
Nice.
Like, if you...
you know, they've had 1,300 years to perfect it.
Yeah, absolutely.
Have they got any guests who've been there the entire time?
I'd absolutely love that.
One Japanese major still comes out and has his breakfast at 7:30 a.m. sharp.
Yeah, still thinks they're at war with Manchuria. If you order dinner there, it's all served in your room to you, course by course, and it's all beautiful, spare, like soba noodles and sushi. And if it's your birthday, you get served a birthday cake. Anything you want is not too much trouble. So I think is the greatest lodgings in the world because it's got roots. So that's my suggestion.
What's that place called?
Nishiyama Onsen Keiunkan.
Where would you rather stay? In this beautiful minimalist hotel where everything's laid out for you, or this beautiful minimalist house where it's self-catering? So it depends what you like. Do you like self-catering or do you like hotel stay?
I mean, if I can bring my mum, then self-catering.
Yeah, this is true. Let's go. As the prize for being the best cook, bring Deanna to Falling Water and stay there.
Great. That works for me.
Excellent. Well done, Falling Water, the world's best lodgings.
And well done, mum, on getting employment.
Finally, we talked about the world's worst screen actor with Christian Talbot, and we picked one of the best comedians of all time, but just... not great on film. Eddie Izzard.
Sorry, Eddie.
We love you, really.
The thing that also really hurts is that Eddie wanted to be an actor more than a stand-up, I think. Then again, I wanted to be a rock and roll star more than a comedian, but I know my limits.
Yeah.
He can't shake off his inherent Izzardness enough. Like I'm sure I said on the podcast, it's the ones you love that hurt you the most.
Yeah, he hurt you deep.
I looked for the most decorated
actor.
Oh,
yeah. Very good.
And I looked for an actor who is... the most bang for his buck in terms of screen acting.
Ah.
And this is a gentleman called John Holland Cazale. He appeared in just 5 films over 6 years, and every single film was nominated for the Best Picture at the Academy Awards.
Say what?
Mm-hmm.
That's good.
He was in The Godfather, The Conversation, The Godfather Part 2, Dog Day Afternoon, and The Deer Hunter. And then when Godfather Part 3 was released, they used archival footage to pop him in that, thus ruining his record.
Oh, guys. Why was he only in such a short, small number of films?
Well, I think sadly probably what it is because he got into screen acting at the start of the 70s and he died at the end of the 70s of lung cancer. He went to drama school and in 1959 he was working as a cab driver and started his theatrical career appearing in Hotel Paradiso and Our Town. And how's this for an opening review? Imagine the first production you were ever in and whatever review you may or may not have got. This is what you got from the critic Jean-Pierre Frankenhuis. Cazale's portrayal is absolutely stupendous. Hilarious, touching, thrilling. We found ourselves wishing that there were more scenes with him, such as the enjoyable performance he gives, a comedian of the first order.
Wow.
Showing range, because obviously in The Godfather he plays Fredo.
Oh, is that who he plays?
Yeah.
Oh, wow.
He had this ability, a co-star of his said, to open up his heart so it could be hurt. So clearly he knew how to show that vulnerability. He was also had a romantic relationship with Meryl Streep, and she was his partner when he passed away.
Oh, wow.
And she described his abilities when they acted on stage, going, "The jerk made everything mean something. Such good judgment, such uncluttered thought." Yeah, he's my choice, just because he turned up, did his business, fucked off this mortal coil.
Everything he touched turned to gold.
Yep.
Well, let's talk about Daniel Day-Lewis. Let's go big. How can you not be the world's best actor when you are the son of a poet laureate, the grandson of the man who ran the Ealing Film Studios, Michael Balkin, and the husband of Arthur Miller's daughter? Yeah. I mean, that's pretty good already. Family grounding, pretty strong. He's the only man to win 3 Best Actor Oscars.
That was what? Lost the Mohicans, My Left Foot, and Guns of New York.
My Left Foot, There Will Be Blood, and Lincoln.
Oh!
See, that's the thing. He's so good in so many films. You forget which ones are the ones he gets Oscars for. Yes, he won for My Left Foot in 1989. There Will Be Blood, I think, 2008, and Lincoln 2012 or 2013. He was also nominated for 3 other Oscars for In the Name of the Father, Gangs of New York, and The Phantom Thread, the last one he made in 2017. And
The Phantom Thread, is he playing Anakin Skywalker in that?
Anakin Skywalker's Taylor.
Yeah.
If you haven't seen it, he's really good in it. And this is such an understatement. He's really fucking good at everything. Is he also the only actor to have won the Big Five awards twice? So there was a couple of lists that I found where they were like, who are the actors who have won the Oscar, BAFTA, Screen Actors Guild Award, the Critics' Choice Award, and the Golden Globe for the same role in the same year? And there's about 30 or so female and male actors. He's the only one to have done it twice, for There Will Be Blood and for Lincoln.
It's like when you look at the footballing records of Messi and Ronaldo,
yeah,
and they just make everyone else's record pale into comparison.
Absolutely.
Like, world-class footballers, you look like schoolboys because of them, and he's the same.
Yeah. He's only been in 21 films. That's if you include an uncredited role in Sunday Bloody Sunday in the 70s.
Yeah, and in Hook.
And
he played the crocodile.
He was the crocodile. Very, he disappeared into that role.
Yeah.
And since his first Oscar win for My Left Foot in 1989, he's only been in 12 films. That's in 30 years.
And didn't he disappear and went to live in Italy and work as a cobbler and
cabinet,
stuff like that?
Yeah, cabinet maker. He was big, he did woodwork in the 70s. He was quite sort of into that, and he went back to it. Obviously, he's famous for his method acting.
Mm-hmm.
He learned Czech while filming The Unbearable Lightness of Being. He insisted on remaining in his wheelchair, being non-communicative, and being spoon-fed during the filming of My Left Foot, because he wanted to experience the difficulties of being somebody who's wheelchair-bound, and also including the embarrassing moments, so with people swearing at him for being difficult, he was like, no, this is a reality for the character I'm playing sometimes.
I mean, I both admire that and find it slightly frustrating. It's the old, is it Gail Goodness or John Mills? The whole, have you tried acting, darling?
Yes, yeah. he learned how to be a knife thrower from circus performers while filming Gangs of New York.
Apparently, he had the trailer next to DiCaprio's, and he would sort of go back to his trailer, slam the door, and just be in there butchering meat in between takes.
Of course he would be. He also contracted pneumonia while filming it, and refused the offer of warmer clothes because he said they were not of the period. Eventually he had to cave in and get medical attention because they're like, no, genuinely, Daniel Day-Lewis is really ill.
Yeah.
it's my greatest role yet. When Spielberg asked him to appear as Lincoln, he said, I need a year to prepare. And in that year, read 100 books on Abraham Lincoln and spent all the time working with the makeup crew on creating the look and the feel for his body and all that sort of stuff.
Well, because Lincoln is a remarkable-looking human being.
Yeah.
And he was huge, Lincoln. He was 6'4", 6'5".
Yeah, yeah, he dwarfed everyone else around him. When preparing to film The Age of Innocence, Day-Lewis spent 2 months in New York City wearing 1870s wear. It's the Gilded Age look, so with top hat and a cape and cane, just walking around. And, you know, probably not the weirdest thing anyone in New York City had seen that day either.
Nope.
He lost 30 pounds and went training with the world champion boxer Barry McGuigan while preparing for Jim Sheridan's film The Boxer. And for Last of the Mohican, he decided to learn how to live off the land, build canoes, and while on set, carried the long rifle that his character carries in the film at all times. Great on screen, very good on stage by all accounts, but hasn't appeared on stage for 30 years. Because when he was appearing in Hamlet at the National Theatre in 1989, during the scene where Hamlet's father appears to him as a ghost, he broke down claiming he had seen the ghost of his own father at the time. And so hasn't returned to the stage since. But I mean, everything you watch him in, he absolutely sings out. Because he's so deep into the role. And it can almost be distracting how different he is to everybody else in the film, nearly.
It's like seeing Ian McKellen when I've seen him live. I've seen McKellen live twice, and once was in pantomime. And he stood out because he was brilliant, but also because the pantomime was so poor that he was in.
Yeah, yeah.
But the other thing was in Waiting for Godot. And it's the Lionel Messi Ronaldo thing. He was opposite Sir Patrick Stewart. Yeah. No slouch.
Yeah.
And he made Patrick Stewart look like he was in Amdram. I don't know how he did it, because it wasn't pure charisma or technical skill, but he... he came into the foreground. Yeah. And Daniel Day-Lewis does that as well. Yeah. It's almost like he makes the camera focus on him even more.
Yeah. Well, I mean, two big hitters. Daniel Day-Lewis, probably lauded as the greatest screen actor of his age, certainly. And John Cazale, maybe not so lauded, but definitely had the magic touch. So who are we going to pick?
The thing is, I'm tempted to go with mine because he feels more on point for this podcast. Mm. He's like a heroic failure winner.
Yeah. And, you know, deserves more people to know about him as well, by the sound of things.
Yeah, everyone knows about Day-Lewis.
Yeah, exactly. He's won enough awards. This is going to be a drop in the ocean to him.
The thing that you don't realise is that actually Daniel Day-Lewis went method and played John Cazale.
And he was very good.
Yeah.
Very good. John Cazale. And then played the crocodile.
Yeah.
As John Cazale playing the crocodile.
Just layers within layers within layers.
Well, that's it. If you enjoyed the show, as ever, give us a like and a review and all of that on the places that you normally listen to us. And get in touch if you want to suggest other slightly different podcasts that you think we should do. We're always looking for new and interesting ways to bring you new and interesting stuff.
Mm-hmm. Yes, we are.
Meanwhile, we're all off to go get your mum to cook us some chicken soup. Over the edge of a waterfall. What's that crocodile down there I can see in the water?
Oh. Hey, Daniel.
Hey, Dan. He's just preparing for his next role. Thank you very much for listening to Worst Foot Forward. Bye.
Goodbye.
Worst Foot Forward is part of Podnose, the UK's leading independent entertainment podcasting network. For episode archives of Worst Foot Forward and all of the shows on the network, visit us at www.podnose.com. You can also follow us on Twitter via @podnose or send us an email via admin@podnose.com.